Population is growing exponentially. Food production only grows linearly. When they cross, we got ourselves a crisis. Hello, nice to meet you. My name is Thomas Malthus. I'm an English old demographer. My sad predictions make me quite unpopular. Don't you know our planet will be doomed at this current rate that the population's doomed? Only three things can be done to slow it down: war, disease, and the plants turning brown. I'm here to tell you.
Hello, K-Squid listeners, and welcome to Sustainability Now. That was the Malthusian Catastrophe Rap by Jordan White, a human geography and history teacher in Duluth, Georgia. You can find his YouTube channel by going on to YouTube and looking for Jordan White, Malthusian Catastrophe Rap. Well, you're listening to Sustainability Now, a biweekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. Abortion is in the news, and nowadays, one's political affiliation is often a clue to one's position on abortion, and vice versa, although not in Kansas. But this was not always the case. During the 1950s and into the 1970s, Republicans were often supporters of abortion as a form of family planning, especially in developing countries, but in the United States too. And they were, at the time, allies of many environmentalists who were worried about the so-called population explosion. My guest today is Dr. Carolyn Tracy, who I believe recently received her PhD in geography from UC Berkeley. We'll check with her on that. On June 18th, she published an essay in the San Francisco Chronicle with a title, How My Republican Grandfather Helped Legalize Abortion. In the article, she recounted the relationship more than 50 years ago amongst Republicans, environmentalists, and abortion. While there's a tendency to regard those Republicans such as Nelson Rockefeller, for those of you who might remember him, as moderates or even liberals, they were strongly influenced by fears of communism, the so-called population explosion, and what they saw feared was a looming shortage of food worldwide. Now, communism did not exist in 1798 when the Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus first published his essay on the principle of population, which was what that introductory song was about. Yet those Republicans and others were committed to his arguments about the poor and population increases. And those beliefs and arguments continue 225 years later to infuse political discourse. Well, Carolyn Tracy, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Welcome to Sustainability Now. It's a timely topic, to say the least, but not well known to the general public.
Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. So why don't you start by telling us something about yourself? Are you a newly minted Berkeley PhD, and in what field?
Yes, I am. It's only been a few times that I've been referred to as Dr. Caroline Tracy, so it's a little bit thrilling. I finished my PhD in human geography this spring in May, and I wrote my thesis actually about deportation and return migration and how people make lives in Mexico after return migrating or being deported. So my focus was on the border and migration and the geography of the American West and the ways that it plays into those dynamics.
And, well, what are you doing now? Are you still in California, or have you departed for other parts?
I now live in Tucson, and I work as a journalist. So I work 4 days a week at the High Country News, which is a magazine that covers the U.S. West.
Yes.
And I specifically cover climate justice. And then on a sort of more part-time basis, I work at Zocalo Public Square, which is where my essay initially appeared, and then it was reprinted in the San Francisco Chronicle, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
And there we focus on kind of a marketplace of ideas about bringing lots of new research and innovative thinking to a general audience.
Well, I can say I read the Zocalo Public Square every Sunday morning while I'm having coffee. And the High Country News is a pretty impressive place to be. So what prompted you to write the piece? Maybe you can also tell us what was in it. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. The essay is one that I had thought about writing a few years ago when my grandfather died, because as a result of studying geography, I had learned some things that had helped me answer a question that I had had for a long time, which was, why did my grandfather, who was a Republican environmentalist, essentially. That was his career path in the state legislature in Colorado. Why was this thing that seemed unusual in his path, which was having helped legalize abortion and make Colorado the first state to do so, why was that part of, how did that make sense in his career trajectory? And I started to learn about the ways that the ideas of Thomas Malthus had recurred in the United States in the 20th century. And so what's in the essay is first about what my grandfather's role in Colorado politics was, and then what were the intellectual ideas that shaped him. So a big influence for him was Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, yeah. And that came out in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And it was part of a big zeitgeist of thinking and concern about global population growth that some scholars have characterized as neo-Malthusian, which I guess we can get into here.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, go ahead and tell us what neo-Malthusian means.
Sure. I guess maybe it would be useful to start with what is Malthusian. Should I start there?
I mean, you could even start with who was Thomas Malthus, although I can fill that one in too.
Yeah, well, I can tell you what I know. You might have more to fill in. Malthus was a English professor of political economy in the late 18th century, early 19th century, and he published a book called An Essay on the Principle of Population, initially in 1798, but there were six editions in his lifetime, so he revised it, I guess, obsessively, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And the book had two, he called them postulata. One is that food is necessary for existence, and the other is that reproduction is necessary, or reproduction is inevitable. Passion is inevitable, in fact. And the problem that he saw is that population grows geometrically, it grows exponentially, and food can only grow, according to him, arithmetically. You can just add more land, but you can't increase the productivity of the land. And of course, he couldn't anticipate the Green Revolution or many of the technological advances in crop science that we live with today. But he, because of those postulata, believed that there would be checks on the population growth, that as humans continued to reproduce, famine would necessarily stop that growth that was naturally growing geometrically.
My sort of recollection of this is that he was writing, sort of looking out his window and seeing poor people wandering about the neighborhood. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that's my understanding as well, that, you know, there wasn't really demographic data at that time. That was something that was new in the 20th century. And so he was really responding to an increased visibility of the poor, and that came from, I think, mainly from changes in the economy, from new urbanization and industrialization that also in Britain had enclosure of land. So the denial of public or communal farming grounds kicked a lot of people out of their livelihoods. And so they were pushed into slums that were in the service of new industrializing cities and or sort of proto-industrializing cities, and suddenly the poor were more visible, whereas maybe they had been farmers before or peasants.
Well, some number of them had, I believe, been involved in the putting out system, which was basically they were doing weaving and, you know, whatever it is, whatever's required to make cloth, doing that at home, and with industrialization and factories, all of that could be centralized. So they either had to migrate to where the factories were, or they had to find another way to make a living. But it was that they were looking for work, and it was the first, I think, example of a phenomenon. Sorry, I'm lecturing about this, but people migrating from rural areas where there was no work to urban areas where there was, hopefully, employment. So, I mean, he sort of got it wrong, in the sense of he thought that the poor were just simply reproducing uncontrollably, And that was why so many people were wandering around. You wrote in your article that historian Thomas Robertson argued that the origins of the U.S. environmental movement lie not in Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, but in a revival and reinvention of the ideas of Thomas Malthus. So how were his ideas reinvented and by whom?
Yeah, this book that I reference, I think, at length in my essay was really interesting to me and really helpful in thinking about the problem that I mentioned before about how do you square this environmentalism with helping pass abortion legislation. And so he argues, like that quotation says, that rather than focusing on Silent Spring and DDT and chemicals as the origins of the American environmental movement, actually earlier than that, people were worried about population growth and they were making environmental arguments about population growth. And so he and some other scholars as well have argued that basically at the early 20th century, when they do have demographic data, and also there is also a renewed sort of visibility of population in the form of the world wars and concerns that overpopulation was a factor in starting these wars, there are everyone from politicians to population biologists or ecologists, lots of ecologists, I guess, start to be concerned that these concepts apply to human population growth and the global population. I think, Malthus didn't have the ability to think at a global scale in the same way once they have data and once they have a more interconnected world. So that's one of the big changes from Malthusianism to neo-Malthusianism, is that it becomes a concern about not England, but the whole world and the resources of the whole world. And then the other is that there's this concept of carrying capacity that gets added, and that's something that I think gets largely developed in the United States.
Well, can you say more about that one?
For sure, yeah. I guess carrying capacity is a concept that I was taught about for the first time in biology in ninth grade, so maybe some other people were as well. And what I remember from that class is that the teacher drew a curve on the board, which was sort of, you have a population of an animal, and then it grows, because like Malthus says, it grows exponentially, and it reaches a point where it has no more resources, it's consumed all the resources, and then it plunges and it plummets to a very low level, and then it comes back and stabilizes, but at a lower level. And so the argument, the way I was taught, was there had been a previous carrying capacity, sort of like a dotted line of the level at which the population could be stable. They had surpassed it. That was why they had plummeted. And then they stabilized at a new carrying capacity, which was lower, because they'd sort of ruined the ecosystem and it couldn't support as many species. And so that idea is what these biologists and others who are writing books in the 1950s and 1960s, well, really the 1940s through the 1960s, are referring to. But they're referring to it on a global human scale in a way that doesn't have a lot of empirical basis. And in the essay, I talked about an article that Nathan Sayre, who was actually my PhD advisor at Berkeley, wrote, which is about the history of this concept, which, again, it was sort of a revelatory article for me, because carrying capacity was something that I had learned about in my education, and it was really fascinating to see it historicized. And so he argues that it emerges as a way to measure how much cargo ships can carry. And then in the 1920s, it becomes used by wildlife biologists in the U.S., yeah. So famously Aldo Leopold, who mm-hmm. May be familiar, I guess, to some. He's working in New Mexico. There's an isolated mesa, and there's a big elk die-off, because, in fact, the elk do consume all the resources on this isolated mesa. And this curve that I was taught about in ninth grade biology basically comes out of that elk die-off. But then there's a very quick jump by by some of these population biologists in the 1940s and 1950s to applying it to human population on a global scale. So I believe that the book Road to Survival by William Vogt, which comes out in 1948, I believe that's one of the most famous ones where that link is made. And he's an ornithologist, but he's writing about human population on a global scale.
I wanted to pursue that population biology notion because, of course, part of the reason that you get population growth in these species is that there's a lot of food. And, of course, food varies seasonally depending on weather and rain and all those kinds of things. And so it's not a kind of necessarily inevitable outcome, I think. It's just what was observed by Aldo Leopold and other population biologists. And it is interesting that the scientists who were the advocates of this particular perspective, none of them actually knew very much about human social affairs and relationships.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very interesting, and you know, one telling trajectory is that William Vogt, who I was just mentioning, he publishes a book in 1948, and 3 years later he gets appointed as the national director of Planned Parenthood. And so you see this political coming together of population biology and reproductive politics in a very clear way, I think, in his professional trajectory.
I mean, I should note, of course, that in the aftermath of World War II and the the victory over Japan with the atomic bombings, scientists had very, very high credibility, which is something that seems to be an issue nowadays. But basically, someone like him would have been appointed, you know, head of Planned Parenthood because of his visibility and authority. But I wanted to go back for a moment because there is also a connection here with the eugenics movement, I think, back in at the beginning in the turn of the 20th century and then probably through the beginning of World War I. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I think it is absolutely an important factor in people's thinking about the importance of birth control and reproductive autonomy, but it's not the area I know the most about. But I think it is absolutely there that in more or less implicit or explicit or more or less overt ways, in a lot of these early, especially population control movements, there are concerns about white supremacy and the loss of what are now people calling the replacement theory. I think it's a very similar dynamic, and also classism, right? That we're going to be outnumbered by poor people in a very similar way to what Malthus was worried about. I think these fears seem to recur politically very often, and I think definitely this early 20th century reproductive politics is a moment at which they're recurring.
And that was that I was doing some reading about this, and it actually came out of social Darwinism, which was, of course, a perversion of Darwin's theories, which had to do again with the notion of the survival of the fittest, and that then was brought into arguments about Europe and Europeans and, the role of Europeans in dominating the world. And then the fear of other peoples somehow overthrowing that particular domination. I also recall that the Rockefeller Foundation was rather active before World War II. In this area. Unfortunately, I don't know any of the details, but do you know anything about that?
I guess, I don't know that much about the Rockefeller Foundation specifically, but I think in sort of the broad stroke trajectory, the neo-Malthusianism starts in the aftermath of World War I. So in the interwar period, as people start to assess, well, what happened and why did this happen? And, for instance, Robertson in his book talks about how John Maynard Keynes was worried about the role that population growth played in these wars, and sort of major figures, or also, you know, that's the same period as Margaret Sanger is promoting birth control. And so people start to think about population in that era, and then it really starts to become more mainstream in the late 1940s at the end of World War II. And I guess the Rockefeller Foundation, I wish I knew more about them specifically, but they're very influential in the Green Revolution. Is that right?
Yeah, no, they were sponsoring the research, right? And the Green Revolution was the attempt to increase productivity of grains and cereals, right? And again, and I think in response to this fear of food scarcity, which of course was driven in part by ideas about population growth, especially in what we at that well came to call the developing world later on, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm, you know, I also have this sort of notion, and you know, no one's here to correct me if I'm wrong, but that they were sponsoring some work on birth control at the time, but you know, that's neither here nor there. So, well, let's get back to the post World War II period. Why were these scientists so concerned? I mean, what was the political environment in which all of this was taking place?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Rockefeller Foundation is part of this as well, is that after World War II, you transition into the Cold War and you start to see population concerns become mainstream as part of anti-communism concerns. And so poverty in the third world becomes a national security issue. And I guess for the Rockefeller Foundation, right, that's part of the reason that they need to sponsor food and agricultural technology at the same time as they and others, including the U.S. government, are sponsoring birth control, both domestically and abroad, and also the more eugenics type of work that we now know about, right? Like forced sterilizations, again, both domestically and abroad. And I think that this concern that poverty is going to make people into communists is a big driver of a lot of the activity at this period.
What you made this point, how is poverty going to make people into communists?
I guess the logic was that, you know, if people are going to bed hungry, they're going to want revolution. And so the best thing that could be done for them was to improve their quality of life in a more capitalist society. That's my interpretation of the logic, at least.
The policymakers had the example of the Russian Revolution to look at, right, in which there was, because it was in the middle of World War I, there were all kinds of issues of, you know, provision of basic needs. And I imagine it was an easy jump to say, well, the people rose up and overthrew the empire because they lacked those basic necessities, right? So if you have sufficiently inspirational leaders who are promising you pie in the sky or a better future, right, if you adopt or support socialism and communism, that's a very attractive proposition. The thing is, of course, is that poor people rarely have time to engage in revolution. But that's neither here nor there. So let's go from there then. So what then was the connection that these people drew between that notion of countries going communist and, you know, access to basic needs and resources, global access to resources?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was this concern about the poor becoming communists on a global scale at the same time as there were domestic changes, right? There was the civil rights movement was happening, so you have the same phenomenon that Malthus was seeing, right, of a real restructuring of society and some reactionary fears there. You see the, you know, in 1965 also they rewrite immigration law in the U.S. So you're seeing a lot of societal changes, as well as, I think, in, you know, what I see as the really distinctly Western element here about why is this happening in Colorado and then in California, is that you're also seeing a lot of population growth, regional shifts in population in the U.S. And so I think that these sort of fears become very present and people don't fully know what to do with them. And they're in large part reacting to visibility of more people and poorer people, or more people and people taking advantage of social services or needing them. And there are these quick leaps that aren't fully thought out between the poor abroad and the needs domestically. And I think family planning becomes kind of considered a panacea, like that it's something that could solve a lot of problems. At least that becomes the political vision of what could happen. So you see in the 60s, I think from 1965 to 1968, there are congressional hearings about population and what to do about it. And after that, you see both the U.S. becomes the largest supplier of birth control in the world. So it's in many countries in the world, as well as a large increase from around $9 million per year of a budget for domestic family planning to a sudden jump to $56 million. Mm-hmm. And I think it's both a reaction to these global Cold War fears and to changes domestically.
One of the things I wanted to sort of point out was that, of course, in 1949, the Chinese Communist Party won the Civil War. And that was a big, you know, big chunk of the world's population suddenly becoming communist. And then later, only a few years later, the President Truman appointed a blue ribbon commission to look into the problem of resource supplies, minerals and other kinds of things. And it was sort of characterized as scarcity because supplies would diminish as they were consumed. But the flip side of that was that growing volumes of these minerals were coming from abroad. And so you had, on the one hand, the sort of Malthusian argument about scarcity. And on the other hand, the fear that communist regimes might cut off supplies in order to blackmail the United States and Europe. And of course, it happened to some degree, but it wasn't because of communists. So how did this all connect to early environmentalism? By this, I mean, 1960s.
Yeah. Well, I think that in Colorado, you see in microcosm some of the dynamics that are playing out at the national political scale. So, for instance, the Democratic representative that sponsored the bill that I write about in my essay that liberalized the Colorado abortion laws is Dick Lamb. He was a young and new representative, and one of the things that he pointed to throughout his life as inspiring him to support abortion legislation was that he and his wife traveled to Peru, and they saw a lot of women in a hospital that were there because they had botched abortions. And so I think this sort of bringing the third world home had a role in Colorado state politics as well, not only the way that they were playing out in the congressional level. So that's I think, one important factor here. But I think also what I was mentioning before about the visibility of population growth in Colorado and across the West, because also you see in California a lot of concerns about population growth and the environment. But in the Denver area, right, in the 1950s, Denver doubles in population. And so there are these close-at-hand fears of population growth. And again, I think it's that the legislators didn't fully know what to do with their concerns about the way the world was changing, and they start to coincide with demands that other groups are making, women's groups, even religious groups, right, about the need for family planning and specifically for abortion on top of that. Mm-hmm. In my grandfather's case, he was, I think, pretty inspired by the book, The Population Bomb, the Paul Ehrlich book, which itself was inspired by, you know, a trip to the third world, like a trip to India, seeing poverty, the visibility of poverty. And in addition to that, I think he also had pretty strong cultural attachments to the wide open spaces of the West. He had grown up on a ranch in Wyoming. And in the essay, I mentioned that I tried to send him the article debunking the idea of carrying capacity. And he wrote back refusing to read it because he said he already knew all about carrying capacity because that was a concept that had been used on the ranch in the Forest Service allotments. It was a funny moment for me in thinking about this because he made that direct jump between the Forest Service allotments and the global carrying capacity that the article was in fact debunking, but he didn't, you know, he didn't want to hear it. And so I think that there, you know, he was inspired by a zeitgeist that that was powerful and that felt very urgent, and that now I think with some hindsight looks rather different, and it looks like it was rather classist and somewhat eugenicist. But I think that it's also true that those male legislators, Lamb and my grandfather, by virtue of getting involved in abortion liberalization legislation, they started to learn more, and they sort of passed the baton to the groups that are involved in thinking about women's rights and bodily sovereignty and the things that we associate with the abortion movement today.
Caroline, you mentioned that this the support for abortion that Dick Lamb, when he was in the state legislature, pushed and your grandfather supported, came out of, I guess, concern about amongst people living in Colorado. What was their sort of attitude? You said Denver doubled in size in the 1950s. What were people thinking?
Yeah, I think that there are a handful of factors, right, that go into this. But one of the main factors is that you start to see a real population shift toward the American West in the post-war period, or during World War II and in the post-war period. Colorado and the Front Range, where Denver is, had sort of belated population growth relative to California. So California had really a boom in population during the war period. A lot of the wartime factories were there, and Colorado sees a lot of the federal investment after World War II. So you still have a lot of manufacturing that's defense related in fact, you have more after the war than you have before. So Denver increases in size dramatically, very fast, right after World War II. And I think that as it had in California, that triggers a lot of fears about the loss of things that people hold really dear in the American West, the wide open spaces and the feeling that there is space. And so I think that in addition to the global or kind of small g global, the discourse about population that's happening all around at this time, you also have a very Western concern about population growth and a desire to do something about it. And I think that both of those fears sort of get channeled into concerns about family planning. And but they also don't come out of nowhere. So, you know, in my grandfather's case, I can sort of add to the intellectual genealogy that my great-grandmother, so my grandmother's mother, his mother-in-law, had been involved from the start of Rocky Mountain Planned Parenthood. So there was a bit of a also a precedent for that concern that predates, at least in my family, the World War II period.
Mm-hmm. So it might be useful just to remind us then about how then that it started to intersect with the, you know, emerging environmental movement, which is, you know, usually associated with Rachel Carson, and as Thomas Robertson argued, was not. So what was the more direct connection?
Well, So yeah, Thomas Robinson, like we were mentioning earlier, argues that maybe instead of Rachel Carson and the concern about DDT and chemicals in the environment, we should be thinking about the ways that Neo-Malthusians influenced the 20th century environmental movement. And there's another book that I think also speaks to this in a really interesting way, which is called The Bulldozer in the Countryside by Adam Rome. Mm-hmm. And that's also about how the American environmental movement was shaped by concerns about population growth and how a lot of the legislation that gets passed, especially in California, like the creation of the Coastal Commission and these other types of protections, come out of this post-war period where people were really worried about the changes they were seeing and the rapid development of the suburbs, probably the increase in traffic, the types of things that people, for instance, in Denver right now, which is undergoing another growth in population, love to complain about, and it sort of evokes fear and sometimes reactionary politics. And in this case, I think the fears got, like I've said, channeled into family planning, which it had a sort of a mix of both reactionary and forward-thinking politics in the form that it took.
It becomes very difficult to untangle these different strands. Why don't we talk about the present then? You know, how population growth is not. Many environmentalists don't talk about this anymore. And it's now expressed much more, it seems to me, on the right, you know, people who are committed anti-environmentalists. But it's gotten all tied up then in the politics of abortion and then women's rights and the like. So do we still see this kind of discourse about Malthusian discourse, neo-Malthusian discourse today?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's something that is on my mind as someone covering climate change, because I think one thing I've noticed is that the way that it does recur is less about population directly, and I think there's sort of a neo-Malthusianism to some climate change discourse, that the ways that it's recurred is that we have too many people emitting too much and that population is again a concern. And part of, you know, what I mentioned earlier, I've been trying to untangle this question of how abortion and population and environmentalism go together and went together in my grandfather's career. And I think that that some of those connections are easy to understand why they might be debunked through climate discourse, right? That I think something that was eye-opening for me as someone who'd definitely been schooled by my grandfather politically and taught to be very concerned about population and its effect on the world was learning that in terms of carbon emissions, a very small percentage of people are making almost all the emissions, right? You know, it's like something like 97% of the emissions come from the top 3% of consumers and emitters. And so population really is not the key issue here. And that we need to readjust how we discursively and actively fight climate change, right? So I think that's one way I see neo-Malthusianism coming back. And I think that, you know, in terms of the debates around abortion, to my mind, they are happening at a pretty low level. There's like definitely a very powerful culture war that has consumed the discourse about abortion that's been hard for those who are in favor of abortion rights to fight successfully. That's why we're seeing the political outcomes we are, I guess. But I think that one way that maybe the neo-Malthusianism comes back again is the sort of fears that we're going to have people consuming social services and the visibility of the poor, right?
There's an interesting tension here between what I would call statistics or the discipline of statistics and the individualization of rights over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years, that rights have become the property of individuals, whereas statistics are about large numbers, right? I mean, population biologists are not concerned about individual animals or people. They're just looking at, large bodies of data. Whereas rights, as in the case of abortion rights, are very much about, you know, individual control over bodies. And so there's a sort of a divergence there, which strikes me as kind of interesting. And but you do still see signs of this concern about statistics, so to speak, in some of the right-wing discourses. You mentioned the great replacement theory, right? But there's also a corresponding sort of idea that abortion is also a way of reducing numbers of minority citizens and residents, that it's a, you know, it's a conspiracy by the white overlord, so to speak, to make that particular form of population control, you know, available. So all of these things get really kind of twisted up together. You're mentioning climate change is sort of interesting. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Sure. I guess, you know, I think in observations I've had, that's one of the places that concerns about population have recurred, right? That I would say before climate change was part of the mainstream discourse, environmental discourse, at least that I can remember, because I'm fairly young and it's been present. Most of my life, I feel like there was a feeling of relief that we knew that world population was going to go down, that most of these countries were going to achieve a zero replacement rate, or whatever it's called, fertility
right.
rate of two.
Right.
And so there was sort of a calm. And then I think with climate change, there's a new concern that there are too many people and that, you know, there's a discourse that developing countries are going to start emitting at greater and greater rates because there are more and more people and more and more people in the middle class. And there are these very fear-driven arguments about what will happen that I think, like you say, they're not necessarily based in statistics.
Well, in fact, they are, right? Because if you talk about China's emissions in aggregate, they're greater than the United States. If you talk about them per capita, they're much, much less, because mm-hmm. China is, what, three or four times as populous as the United States. And so that's a way of dealing with the statistics, right, in a different way. It's an aggregation as opposed to the sort of individualization of consumption.
Right, that's a good point. Yeah, and it's about, you know, I think it's just very interesting for me to observe the way that it's somehow easier to make this sort of fear-driven leap to, even if it's lower per capita right now, it's going to grow so significantly that it will become, you know, par with our consumption. There's a fear on Americans' part, or a reluctance to question our own consumption levels, right? And the other statistic, which is that the vast majority of us are in the very tiny fraction of major consumers and emitters,
right.
And that has really shaped the global climate change landscape.
Beginning back in the 1980s, when the climate, you know, concerns about climate started to emerge on a much broader scale. Caroline, what sorts of work are you planning to do? Are you going to do anything around this issue in your, you know, in your career in the near term?
Yeah, I guess it's hard to avoid it, because I do think that both, the question of abortion rights is very present right now this year, of course, and climate change is abidingly important as well. So yes, I guess this is the short answer. Right now, working as a climate justice reporter.
Oh yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, I think both these questions are are very much on my mind. I've been here. I'm here in Southern Arizona, so I've been doing some interviews with women in Mexico who are parts of networks of abortion providers there, in states both where the laws have been liberalized and where they haven't, and trying to figure out how the cross-border relationship is going to change as the laws are changing here, because as maybe you know, Arizona has had a challenging time putting its abortion ban into effect because it had two on the books. and then in terms of climate justice reporting, I feel like that's in some ways working against the neo-Malthusianism and demonstrating that in fact it's not a generalized phenomenon that everyone is feeling the effects of equally because we're all sort of too big of a population, but rather that climate change affects different people differently. So I'm just wrapping up a story that'll come out in a couple months about how manufactured homes are particularly vulnerable to excessive heat, and there are really disproportionate statistics about heat-related deaths in Arizona. I think the statistic is that they're eight more. If you live in a manufactured home, you're eight times more likely to die in an excessive heat event. So, those are the types of stories that climate justice entails. Sort of looking at the variations in the effects of climate change rather than the overall kind of statistical effect.
I'm just curious. Is that because the inhabitants of mobile homes are more likely to be poor and less likely to have air conditioning? Is that the connection?
That is part of it. It's again one of these things where there are a number of factors to untangle. One of the issues is that the construction of the homes themselves is not particularly weatherized, especially older homes.
Sure.
Homes from before 1976 is really the worst, but even before 1990, they're very thin walls and not sufficient weatherization. But then also, residents of manufactured homes are on average lower income than either owners or renters of site-built housing. And then there's another wrinkle, which is a particularly substantive one that some researchers at Arizona State University sort of uncovered by doing comparative mapping, which is that residents of trailer parks don't have access to a lot of utility assistance programs because those parks are sub-metered. So only the park is the direct direct customer of the utility. And so even people who could qualify for utility assistance often cannot get it. And that's a big issue here in Arizona.
That's because there's one master meter for the whole park, right? For
exactly.
Electricity and gas. And then the owner of the park resells the electricity and gas to the residents.
Yeah, they're essentially subcontracted and they're required by law to sell the electricity at the same price. They can't gouge the residents. It does make it complicated, if not impossible, for residents to get utility assistance.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, it was a great conversation. You can read more of Carolyn Tracy's writing by following the hyperlinks on the blurb for this broadcast on the K-Squid website. Or, of course, you can always Google Caroline E. Tracy, and she will turn up. She has her own website and appears in many other places. So once again, Caroline, thank you.
Thank you.
So thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station and keep it going. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Population is growing exponentially. Food production only grows linearly. When they cross, we got ourselves a crisis. Hello, nice to meet you. My name is Thomas Malthus. I'm an English old demographer. My sad predictions make me quite unpopular. Don't you know our planet will be doomed at this current rate that the population zooms? Only three things can be done to slow it down: war, disease, and the plants turning brown. I'm here to tell you there's too many babies, but all you English folks look at me like I'm crazy. All of us will return to farms consistently if the babies keep getting born consistently. While I'm sitting and preaching, let me tell you more. All the problems fall squarely on the poor.
So if you want to avoid a catastrophe, the world's about to hit its carry capacity. Hopefully you're on the right side of the J curve. If not, food will be pretty tough to serve. Population is growing exponentially. Food production only grows linearly. When they cross, we got ourselves a crisis. Goodbye, y'all. I'm Thomas Malthus.